Oh, the boss battles and oh, they're awful.
Welcome to Up Up Down Down, the highest rated games criticism show that I personally host. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision. He's now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
This week, we also welcome Tyson Kalberg. Tyson is a designer at Asana, a passionate critic of games, and is our official representative today of hardcore gamers worldwide. Hi, Tyson.
Hey, hey.
So today, our topic is game difficulty, specifically the trends in game difficulty over time. Are they getting easier? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? And what have we learned in game design over the last 40 years or however long games have been part of our culture. So sort of as the backstory, what sets the story for all of this is the arcade games, obviously, the origins of mainstream gaming, at least when we're not talking about some game that prints out onto some little mainframe dot matrix printer in the 60s. In the arcades, you had these machines that you had to you had to fill with coins in order for them to keep working. And if the players didn't die within 2 or 5 minutes, then your arcade's losing money. And in that era, we developed the sensibility around games that hard games were awesome because they were really satisfying when you beat them. But over the last couple decades, we've realized that you can actually have some really satisfying games that aren't even that you can't even die. You know, look at something like Gone Home. And my personal take on that is that's a good thing, and I enjoy actually finishing games, which is something I basically didn't really ever do for this long stretch in between when I got a job and the last like few years when it's become cool to make a game that isn't insanely hard. But this is very controversial. So I wanted to sort of bring Nigel and Tyson onto the show and ask for some thoughts about, starting things off, how much easier are games than they were 20 or 30 years ago?
I mean, I think that really depends on the genre you're talking about. Like, I don't know, I've been playing like a lot of Super Hexagon on my iPhone, and that game is ruthlessly difficult. Like, I've gotten to the last level, and I can't, for the life of me, like, get to the 60-second mark, and even that is, like, ridiculous. Whereas, like, when you look at other games, like, I feel like certain genres, especially ones that are probably considered more mainstream, or, I guess casual is probably the right buzzword, those are definitely, like, a lot easier than sort of what I grew up with and what you guys grew up with.
Yeah, well, there's two really interesting side offshoots on this topic, which are the casual games like Farmville and stuff that have become way easier than mainstream games. And then there's these indie games like Super Meat Boy and Super Hexagon, really super what have you, that are going crazy with the difficulty. But if we just think about or start with the AAA mainstream games, like whatever is the top five sort of best-selling games at retail, my impression has been, either I'm getting easier or I'm getting better at games, which I doubt, that they're the culture around it is that they should try and actually make it so on the default difficulty setting that more people are going to finish the game. Like, what were the stats on how many people were not finishing games? It's crazy.
I think there's definitely some games you can use as kind of a calibration point for that kind of stuff to prove that games are actually getting easier. The 2D side-scrolling Super Mario series is a fantastic example of that, because they've been doing those games basically since the dawn of home console entertainment. You can still go back and play the older versions via, like, the Wii Virtual Console. You can try, as I have, controlled experiments with your children to try and figure out how hard they find various eras of the Mario games, and you can see a really clear trend in those games towards them being a lot more easy to succeed at the basics over time. Like, there's still hard portions of the game, but they tend to make the hard portion be extra stuff, right? That you can go and try and collect all the coins on a level, and you can try and find various secrets, but you don't need to do those to play the main game. And with the new Mario games, like, the old Mario games were always just a huge amount of management of extra lives. And, like, was I going to be able to make it? And my kids are playing Super Mario 3D World now, the new Wii one, and they have literally hundreds of extra lives. And it's comical, right? Like, they're never possibly going to even use a continue.
And this is like a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old still have hundreds of lives.
No, this is a 10-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 4-year-old playing the game together. Yeah. And they're doing fine.
Why do they have a concept of lives in the game at all at that point?
I don't know. It's a little ridiculous. But I've gone back and played like Super Mario Brothers 3, which is my all-time favorite Mario game. And it's still hard. Like, I still have a hard time with it. I can do better at it than they can because I played through it dozens of times, so I know some of the tricks, but that, like, it's really challenging for them, and I shudder to think how they do with something like the Lost Levels. That would just destroy them.
So the Lost Levels is the Mario game that was Super Mario Brothers 2 in Japan, but then when they wanted to bring it to the United States, it was deemed so hard that or you know, North America, that we wouldn't even be able to handle it. It's extreme difficulty, and so Super Mario 2 in our eyes is actually a fake.
Yeah, until it appears in Mario All-Stars on Super Nintendo, which is sort of what I grew up with, and it was ruthlessly difficult. I mean, that brings up an interesting point, right? Because I feel like one of the biggest changes with gaming from sort of back then to now, and I think part of this is also hardware constrained, was the idea of sort of this aggressive checkpointing that we're seeing a lot today, where, like, Super Meat Boy, while is incredibly difficult, like, you get to restart, like, immediately from where you were. And likewise, you're seeing this in, like, a bunch of games, like, even Mario. I mean, the lives aren't a direct sort of checkpoint mechanic, but, like, even Super Mario World, like, if you lost all your lives before you got to the next castle or the next ghost house, you'd, like, lose all that progress. And I think we've seen, to me, like, the sort of idea of hardness and easiness is kind of directly related to how much time you're sinking into it, and sort of the punishment for failure.
I guess there's two components to how hard a game is. There's one component is literally the amount of skill as a sort of human input that you need to hit this sort of minimum skill bar to be able to complete the game. And the other is how much frustration the game brings out in you as you go through it as just part of the process. You know, and so you could have a game that actually doesn't have very much in terms of necessary skill, but just has a lot of really arbitrary random things where you just walk around a corner and then you just immediately fall in a pit and die if you didn't realize there was a pit there when there's no way you could have known. And that's really hard, but it's not, you know, doesn't require any skill.
Well, and I don't know if I necessarily define that as hard as much as it's just bad design. Like, I think as games have gotten better, we've realized that doing things like that to the player are just kind of shitty things to do. Like, I mean, assuming you guys have played, like, the original Mega Man series on NES.
Yes.
Yeah.
That game, like, mechanically is incredibly tight. Like, the controls are really good, and the levels are really well designed. And, like, they even go to, like, to lengths where, like, they're leading you through progressive learning stages. So, like, I think it's, like, Quick Man in Mega Man 2 when you, like, fall down the pit and, like, the beams come from either side. And if you get caught in the beam, you die instantly. But they sort of ease you into that. Like, there's a lot of really clever design decisions where they don't just sort of, like, screw you right away. Whereas I feel like sort of historically, especially like in the NES days, there were a lot of times when the design was just kind of really hard-edged. And it was like, well, you've learned this now, but we didn't really ease you into it, but tough shit. And I feel like we've just gotten a lot better at learning how to ease players into that kind of difficulty. Whereas like things like even a game that's really hard can still be mechanically very, very satisfying.
Well, you mentioned, you referred to the sort of constraints that old games have. And that it used to be that literally you had 4 kilobytes of memory on this arcade machine, and that you couldn't actually have a game that had checkpoints every few minutes because there's really, you can only fit like an hour of gameplay onto this chip if you're lucky. And so in order to give you $60 of value or what have you, you need to die repeatedly and play the first minute and the first 2 minutes over and over and over again in order to actually get some reasonable length out of the game.
There also just is the arcade factor of you're renting space. In the arcade days, you needed to have a, you know, building that you'd rented that you were going to put a bunch of arcade machines in, and each of them is occupying like 4 square feet of floor space. And if you don't have users pumping enough quarters into those to pay your rent, then you go out of business. And so there's a really strong incentive to have the difficulty curve tuned so that people are pumping in money at a particular rate in order for the economics to work. And that's just not true anymore. Like, the games no longer occupy any real physical space. You know, most people are playing games on their PCs at home, and there's no ongoing costs once you've purchased the game, setting aside, you know, the various in-app purchase scummery and stuff like that. There's no reason to make the games unenjoyable for people in order to extend the playtime. And there is, sure, I think some of it probably is those kind of technical constraints you were talking about it, but even in the absence of those technical constraints, arcades, I think, still would have been like that. If you look at modern arcade games that don't have those technical constraints, they're just as bad. Even the, you know, you go into any arcade now, which admittedly they're getting pretty hard to find. The games that are the most popular there, as far as I've been able to tell, are like the games that require physical peripherals, right? So like the shooting games and stuff like that. And those, I wouldn't say they're as hard as some of the early arcade games, but they're certainly just as bad about sucking money out of your wallet. Like, they have a very aggressive difficulty ramp in terms of how quickly your character gets taken out.
Yeah, it's funny. I was in Tokyo in June, and we went to a bunch of arcades because, you know, arcades, I'm fairly young, so, like, I didn't really get to grow up with arcades a lot. We had one, like, you know, there was one in the mall, but it wasn't to the same extent, like, the 80s, sort of that, like, golden age of arcades. But going there, it was super interesting because I remember sitting down with, like, a cup full of like 100 yen coins, and it would just destroy them. And I mean, it was enhanced by the fact that like Japanese games are just really hard in general. But I remember like playing a bunch of the shooting games, and yeah, it would sort of like, you'd get the early levels and feel like, oh yeah, I'm feeling pretty badass, like I haven't taken any damage. And then it's just like bang, bang, bang. You've like gone through $5 all of a sudden, you don't even realize it. And I mean, yeah, to your point, like, those games are there to make money. So if you're sitting there able to beat it, you know, over and over again, no one's making anything off of that.
One of the things that I think happened in the move to home consoles and to PC games and stuff like that is that it's not so much necessarily that the maximum amount of difficulty got less for games, it's that the range of difficulties widened, right? That's the thing you can do when you don't have those hard constraints of, well, if we make the game too easy, someone can sit there and play indefinitely on it and not make us any money. And you can say, well, we'll support an easier game for people that aren't as good at it, and we'll support a harder game for people that are better at it. And that's the sort of thing, like I was saying when I was talking about the Mario games, is that it's not necessarily that the hardest stuff in those games has gotten any easier. It's that you don't need to do the hardest stuff anymore to get through the game. You can play all the way through the game only doing fairly simple stuff and get to the end and be like, yep, I beat the game. And then if you want to go back and try and collect every single shiny, you know, the big shiny coins on every level, you can do it, but that's on you. You know, you kind of got to decide that you're going to take that route and take on those challenges. Whereas, you know, going back to like Super Mario Brothers 1, 2, 3, you had to do everything. Like, there was only one path through the game aside from the couple of warp zones that were available. So every player that was going to play the game without warp zones had to take on the same challenge, basically. And so there was that gating effect on who could enjoy the game based on how skilled they were.
Yeah, and even if you did get the warp whistles, like, you always still had to play through that last world, which is just brutal. Like, in Mario 3 and Mario Brothers Original, like, those, like, world 8s were just nasty. Whereas, like, I feel like I'm trying to think of when the turning point was for that, because I'm, like, I'm thinking of Super Mario World, and, like, it was pretty hard, but, like, the hardest levels were, like you said, they were behind a gate, like, they were in, like, the Star Road thing, and there was, like, the secret Star Road levels that were just, like, just brutally difficult. And then, like, Mario 64, you can kind of get through it fairly easily, and that, like, you don't have to go for the 120 stars, and, like, the path to, I think it's, like, 60 to beat it actually isn't that bad. And I'm kind of curious to know, like, I'm just thinking about it, like, whether or not, how do you guys feel about it? Like, do you feel like the 16-bit era sort of started becoming easier, so to speak?
I think it was, I mean, the 16-bit era was definitely easier than the 8-bit era. Like, 8-bit had games like Battletoads that I've never heard anyone say anything about Battletoads other than, man, that game was really freaking hard. And there was games, I mean, I was young at the time, but there's games I had on the NES that I didn't even really understand how to play them. Like, I could beat Mario Brothers and Link and a bunch of these games, but there's games that we had that, I mean, they were also just badly designed, but it was considered okay for it to be not obvious how to even play the game in the sort of earlier eras, whereas now it's considered rightly a failure if, you know, a kid cannot at least you know, play a decent amount of your game. And that's something that every generation, I think, has improved on. And to some degree, it's just getting rid of that legacy of the arcade history. But it's also the mainstreaming of games and this perception that it's okay to have the really challenging, frustrating, brutal stuff in the hard mode or the hell mode or whatever.
Yeah, there's certainly some games that even make a point about that. Like BioShock Infinite had that 1999 mode, which I haven't tried playing the game in that mode at all, but it's, you know, they specifically said, like, here's a mode that we put in that we think is going to be too hard for most people, so we're going to hide it away. I can think of a couple other first-person shooters that have done that, where they've had, like, a extremely hard difficulty mode that you need to unlock by playing through the game once, and then you get a shot at, like, okay, here's this nuts mode that you can play it in again. Max Payne, I think. I have clear memories of them doing that. That it unlocked, like, a really difficult mode where you had to play through the whole game on the hardest difficulty level to begin with, but then also in, like, a limited amount of time where you know, you basically had a clock ticking on each level that you had to get through the whole game in that time. And it was brutal. Like, I enjoyed the game quite a bit and found the first playthrough challenging. And then I'm like, all right, I'll try this harder difficulty mode. And I couldn't do it. Like, I wasn't good enough.
It's interesting that decision in between are difficulty modes unlocked or they open by default, because they make different statements about what that different mode is. If the new difficulty level, the harder difficulty levels are available by default, then it's like, okay, well, we've actually balanced these so that you could maybe just reasonably play them, which is probably the ideal circumstance. Somebody who knows that they want more of a challenge, it would be nice if they could start on hard or maybe very hard and have a reasonably balanced game that they wouldn't have to have played through it before. But in practice, that's, you know, a bunch of extra work that maybe doesn't sell a lot of extra copies of the game. So often you get this circumstance where all they're doing to make the extra layers harder is just cranking up these numbers. So you get everybody does twice as much damage, or you have twice as much health, or the enemies are twice as likely to notice you. And that gets to a point where unless you've already seen this level before, you'll just die instantly. And there's no way, you can't even learn the level by trial and error because it's so hard if you've never seen it before.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, like, a replayability and, like, nostalgia aspect to that, too, right? Like, I know when I have that bad habit of whenever I start a game, I'll be like, oh, I'm going to try the hardest difficulty level because I'm good at games and I should be able to do this. I can, like, remember distinctly, like, Uncharted, Deus Ex. Deus Ex was... That game was awful in so many ways. Just, I mean, Human Revolution was a fantastic game, but they had these boss battles. I don't know if you guys have played it, but
oh, the boss battles,
terrible.
Oh, they're awful.
It's horrible because, like, the whole game is so good, and you can tailor your character so well to tackle the levels. And the moment you go into a boss battle, everything you expect goes to shit because you have to fight it in one way. It's like the most frustrating thing in the world.
I think that's probably the worst tuned difficulty in any game I played in, like, the last 5 years. I'm thinking about it and I'm having a hard time coming with anything else. It was just that level of, like, throw the controller across the room frustration. Most other times that I've encountered hard sections, it's been like, all right, this is difficult, but I know what I have to do. I can see how I can get good enough to do it. Those boss battles in Human Revolution, I don't even know how many times I played through them trying to get through them. And I just felt like I was basically just playing the random number generator. Like, I was like, all right, I'm just going to try a bunch of stuff and we'll see what happens. And maybe eventually I'll get in enough hits on these guys to take them out. And who knows? Like, I had no plan or strategy or learning curve. It was just try it over and over again until I make it. And yeah, those were horrifyingly bad.
I played through that whole game as a pacifist and, like, customizing my character to be really subtle. And it turns out, actually, yeah, what I needed was a giant freaking rocket launcher, and that I should have just discarded all my inventory for rockets so I could rocket people to death, you know, every few hours. And then the rest of the game I could sneak around.
Well, and that's the part that killed me, is it wasn't so much the boss battles were badly designed if you respect the right way. Like, some of them are, like, genuinely mechanically interesting. But if you hadn't, it seems like they ignored the whole, you know, their this is sort of, you can pick two paths. Like, you can play the silent game and, like, stealth everything, or you can go, like, whole hog and have all the armor and all the weapons, and all the boss battles seem to be tuned really fully to the idea that you have to have all the rockets and all the armor to, like, make it effective. And like you were saying, Nigel, like, I did that a lot where I'd go into a boss battle, and sometimes if I was coming with low health, like, it was literally me running in the room and trying to stay alive long enough to watch what the boss did. Eventually I just got fed up. I'm like, you know what? Screw it. I'm dropping the difficulty level for boss battles. I'll knock them out of the park in 2 seconds and go back to the game that I'm, like, genuinely enjoying playing. And it's kind of a shame.
I knocked the difficulty level down, and still I had to try each of them at least 10 or 15 times to get through them. And I had to do, like, reloads earlier in the level to try and collect extra stuff on at least one of them. I think that I can't even remember. I've blocked them out. I can't remember, like, which order. There's like the woman who you gotta fight who's invisible with the water, yes. And there's the guy who, there's all the exploding barrels around. I can't remember which one you fought first, but the first one I got really caught out by. Like, the subsequent ones, I sort of, once I knew what the problems were, I was a little more careful about managing stuff and making sure I had a couple of ace in the hole kind of weapons and stuff like that. But for the first one, whichever one it was, I had to actually, like, reload. I fortunately had a save game a little farther back through the level, because in games like Deus Ex, where there's lots of branching paths, I tend to keep a couple of stale save games in emergency. And fortunately, I had one that was far enough back that I could play through the section again, come in with more health, get a good gun to take in with me. But, I mean, you probably, it would have been entirely possible to get yourself in a situation where you couldn't have finished one of those boss battles if you hadn't got a save game far enough back and weren't expecting it. You could have just had the autosave, like, right before it, and you didn't have a big enough gun, and you didn't have enough health, and there's just no way you were ever finishing it.
So this is an interesting game design question that, you know, it's really hard to build a game where you give players what they ask for, which is a challenge, and you give players what they ask for, which is customizability. But when you combine those two things together, the game design challenge becomes exponentially harder, because you have to make it so that every way that the players can configure their character is actually possible to beat the bosses, but it's, or just the levels in general, but it's also challenging. I mean, when you get to games like Skyrim and these sorts of things where your character, the level designer has absolutely no idea what your character is like, there's inevitably going to be circumstances where you're like, haha, you level your character up to have 99 sneak, you can just, like, go into the queen's bedroom and, you know, steal her clothes and then, I don't know, whatever. Like, it's just totally ridiculous things that don't make any sense, but the level designer, it hadn't even occurred to them that by that point you might have done that really extreme thing with your character, like I did, where I had no weapons that I could actually hurt anyone because I wasn't intending on hurting anyone, which, I don't know, maybe it's just a naive thing for an assassin in a game world to be doing.
Sounds like you play a lot of passive characters, too.
Yeah, maybe.
I definitely go a lot more stealth. Like, I tend to be more on the aggressive edge of stealth. Like, I certainly had plenty of silent takedown capability, but yeah, I wasn't, I almost never play a walking tank when given the choice in a game, personally, and I was not ready for those Deus Ex boss battles.
Yeah, the thing, this is going to be kind of hearsay because I can't actually reference the article, but I do remember reading something like the boss battles were literally done by, like, a different part of Ubisoft or, like, a different studio, and they were, like, complete, and it's kind of showed, right, because they were completely different than the rest of the game.
Like, yeah, I believe they were outsourced entirely.
Actually. I've heard that from several people, including other people inside the games industry. So I have a high degree of confidence that that's what happened. Like, I definitely don't have any firsthand knowledge. Like, I never talked to anyone who actually worked on the game, but I've heard that enough times from two or three different sources that it really sounds like that's what happened.
Yeah, and it's a shame, right? Because they, like, so much of that game, especially if you're playing a stealth game, they sort of, like, dangled that ghost achievement in front of you, which was, like, don't kill anybody and no one detects you. And, like, that was a really alluring thing to try to get for a while. Eventually, it was, like, it was ridiculously mechanically intensive to, like, go through and do that. Like, it was the point where you'd have to, like, go through a section, then reload, and go through a section and reload. But, like, that kind of stuff, like, that to me is, like, a really good challenge. And it was genuinely, like, quite difficult to achieve. But again, like, to your point, like, it was optional. Like, you did not have to play the game that way.
I find, so one of the aspects, those two things come together really well. One of the aspects of difficulty, what makes something difficult, is not just the mechanical difficulty of executing it, but the feedback loop of the feedback the game is giving you to tell you whether or not you're doing it right. And if you do it wrong, what's going on? And so there's all sorts of game design things that you can do, like in Team Fortress 2, when you die, it will immediately show you the person who shot you and where they were standing and what they were doing. So you can be like, oh yeah, there's a sniper way up there. That makes sense. But when you're trying to go with it and get those stealth achievements in these sorts of games, there's often not even any feedback that you failed. So I've decided I'm going to play through this game and kill nobody. And if you do that, you get some awesome reward. But then at some point, I don't realize it, but I accidentally drop a crate off of a ledge and it lands on some guy who is half dead and then he dies. But I didn't even notice that. And that was like 19 hours of gameplay ago. And then I finish the game and then I don't get the achievement. And then I'm like, excuse me?
Yeah, I worked really hard on this. And it's super funny because like, materially nothing, like for you did your best, and as far as you're concerned you didn't kill anybody, but you don't get that achievement. It's like, why did I even fucking do this? It's so funny that you want, like, you need that reward to sort of recognize that, like, you ticked off all the boxes. And it's so true.
And sometimes it, like, unlocks a different mode, or it gives you, like, the little achievement token on the PlayStation Network. I don't care as much about that, but often it will give you a different ending or something, you know.
Yeah, I remember, like, I don't know, I guess I'm not, like, I wouldn't consider myself an achievement hunter, but, like, I remember at the end of Deus Ex, like, because I tuned the difficulty down on certain sections, it gave me, like, the hard rewards for, like, I think it was, like, the chapters, but then the overall one, I didn't get it, and that just bugged the shit out of me, because I'm like, it's your fault I couldn't do this, like, mm-hmm. These bosses sucked, and fuck, like, come on, it's just so frustrating to me. And, yeah, it's interesting that there's this, I don't know. I guess it speaks to the kind of gamer I am. Like, I am undoubtedly very competitive about games. Like, that's why I play tons of multiplayer games. Because to me, like, single-player games have a certain amount of difficulty to them. In that there's, like, you know, there's a difficulty level you can achieve, and if you beat the game, you've beaten it. But I think what sort of has always bothered me about that is you can kind of reload and do it over and over and over again. Whereas, like, multiplayer games, it's super dynamic, and you're really accountable to your stats, and every shitty round you have, like, speaks to your skill level. And that's really, really appealing to me. Which brings me to my next point, which is, have you guys played fucking XCOM, the new one? That game is fantastic.
No,
I have not.
So, interesting thing about that game, and I feel like the whole classic difficulty thing is very much, it's either, like, studios that are pretty old school, like Irrational's, like, System Shock, and, like, all those, like, really, really hard old school games, like System Shock 2 scared the hell out of me when I was playing it as a kid. And they seem to do a lot of nods to this, but one of the things that XCOM had is they have a difficulty slider from, like, easy to, I think, the last one is, like, classic. And they also have this mode switch called Iron Man. And the principle behind Iron Man is you don't get to save. It saves for you at the end of every mission, and every mistake you make and every soldier that dies, that you have to live with that for the rest of the game. And there's this, like, punishing... Like every mission you go into is terrifying. And I tried to beat the game, like, three or four times. Like, each one was, like, easily a 20-hour playthrough before I failed. And I was trying to play it on, like, hard and then Iron Man. It was ruthless. But there's that jeopardy with that difficulty level that I think is, like, really interesting and kind of more intrinsically a multiplayer thing, and that you don't have this idea of replayability. I don't really know where I was going with that, but I really wanted to mention XCOM, so there we go.
Well, that idea of starting a game and that all the mistakes you make accumulate throughout the game is something that was baked into a lot of the early shooters. Like, you play these early Doom games and things like that, where you get this amount of ammo and you can actually just use it all, and then you just die because you can't shoot at anyone anymore. And this is, you know, in the context of that game, it makes the game more intense and more exhilarating because you don't want to waste your ammo and you're trying to conserve shots, but then you die and what have you. But in a modern context that we look back on it, we're like, that's ridiculous. Like, who wants to be running around trying to punch people to death because you ran out of bullets?
Yeah, I mean, the only games I can think of that still really exert, like, a resource constraint thing are, like, survival horror, like Resident Evil. Last of Us is a great example where, like, if you get callous with your bullets, you're going to pay for it later, and you're either going to have to stealth through the whole thing, or you're going to have to, like, attempt to melee and take tons of damage. But definitely, like, still far more forgiving than, like, old games where, like, you would literally have ammo and there was no way to go back, and you're basically screwed.
I think good checkpointing in games can help, not so much with the actual difficulty, but at least with the feeling of difficulty on that stuff. I find that games that have well-tuned checkpointing systems, I tend to be willing to not micromanage my saves and just say, all right, I'm going to just relax and play the game and try and recover from my errors as best I can in the game and trust that if I totally screw something up and I die, that the last checkpoint will be recently enough that I can reload from that checkpoint. Whereas when games have really bad checkpointing, such that it gets frustrating when you die, then I tend to get in that, like, all right, I'm just going to micromanage my save games, and I'm going to save, like, every 5 minutes. You know, it's like, yeah, it's like the classic Doom, like, quick save button is right there, and you're just, like, hitting the quick save button every 30 seconds, because...
Oh, God, that's a slippery
slope,
too.
You're so scared about losing any, like, progress.
I remember playing Half-Life, and you know, like you were saying, right? Like, you hit that every time you turn a corner, you're like, quick save. I know I'm safe. Quick save.
Yeah.
And I remember a few distinct moments in Half-Life where, like, I'd quick save, like, out of instinct, accidentally, like, maybe accidentally falling in a pit or making a jump, and then you keep reloading and you keep falling into the same trap. And thank God they had two quick saves, because so many times.
Well, my brother was playing Half-Life 2, and he quick saved running down a pipe, and there's a bunch of things chasing him, and he was almost dead, and he had no ammo. I think he might have done it accidentally, and I mean, it was either like he accidentally hit the button or he did it without thinking, and then he just never beat the game because he's just like, yeah, I reloaded like 40 or 50 times, and that was the only quick save I had. So.
Oh, God.
Yep. Yeah, I got about halfway through Half-Life 2.
That's a problem with putting saves under the user control, right? Is you give them a bad difficulty tuning knob. You give them a way to make it easier by doing this constant quick saving and locking in every individual bit of progress. But then you also give them the ability to just put themselves in a situation where they can't win anymore, where they've been caught out and there's just nothing they can do. I think that's something that you got to take into account when you're designing a save system, is how do we encourage people not to ever save manually? Like, make sure that the natural checkpoints are there and the spaces between them are at the right spots, that people won't get nervous about it and say, like, oh, I got to save it manually because the quick save doesn't, or because the built-in checkpoints don't have my back. You want them to always feel like, yeah, it's got my back. And if you do it right, like I said, it makes the game more tense, because you do know you're going to have to redo a little something. You know that you're taking some risk by keeping going, but you're willing to do that all the time without paying attention to what the quick save is, because you know that, well, if I die, I'm not going to go too far back. Designers have picked a reasonable spot for me to go back to.
There's an interesting compromise that they make in modern games, which is that when, because you can get into that circumstance where it auto quick saves for you, and if it saves all your resource depletion, then it can save in a time where you would not have manually saved and also screw you. So you can be like, you have one health and you have one ammo, and then you pass through this thing because you're running away. This happens actually, especially in like last generation games or early in this generation. Often I would flee if I got out of, you know, I was just having a hard time, or I would run into the fray in order to just see what the other side of the level was like before I died. And then it would trick quick save. And it would quick save in a mode where there's like 18 giant beasts chasing me down and there's everything's on fire. And then I was in a really hard spot to try and continue. There's games in the last few years don't do that. They will, when they quick save, they let you keep going from the current state. But if you die, then you start with, you know, 3/4 health or a certain amount of, like, I noticed this happens a lot in Assassin's Creed 4, which I'm playing right now, that actually whenever you load from a quick save, you're full health. So, and there can be times where you get through and you're being really careful to not die, or, you know, not run out of whatever resource. It's your ship in particular, which has fairly persistent health. But if it dies, then it's just like, it's full health now, which is not super satisfying, but it's less annoying.
I mean, I think the sort of rise of better checkpointing is sort of directly related to console gaming sort of becoming more prevalent too, because I feel like quick save, like, to this day is still a thing that kind of exclusive to PC. So you got like an F5 key, like right at the top of your keyboard. Whereas, you know, on the console, you got to press start and you got to go to save. And like, there's all these like arduous steps. And I feel like as console gaming has gotten a lot more mature, we've seen a lot better checkpointing and a lot better pacing with checkpoints. Because the best checkpoints are the ones where like you die and basically there's a chance to get some resources back. Maybe there's some health packs. Maybe they start you with some health. The idea is, like, you're not breaking the flow of that, and you're not feeling completely, like, neutered when you come back into the game. And it's a lot more satisfying to sort of come back and have to play through a section. Like, there's a really good sense of satisfaction where, like, you play through... I had this happen a lot to me in Last of Us, where there'd be, like, this really hard stealth section. I'm like, well, I'm gonna try to get through this, and, like, you die, and you die, and you die. And you have to keep starting from the start, but there'd eventually be this moment where, like, you finally got to it and, like, succeeded. And that was, like, a really, really good moment. I think, had I been quicksaving, it would have been a lot less of a victory for me, because I know I would have been, like, saving every 10 feet and, like, oh, I'm in the safe area on the right now, I can quick save, versus, like, forcing me to play through it every time is actually a much more gratifying gameplay experience.
Some particular gameplay styles work really well with that. Like, stealth is one where a lot of stealth sections, particularly in games like Last of Us that aren't primarily stealth games, are really more puzzle than anything else, right? That once you figure out the path, you can execute portions of the path very repeatably, and you know where the guys are going to be moving in advance, you know what areas are safe. It's not as much like an action sequence where there's a lot of button mashing that you need to do correct and a lot of skill that you need to re-execute with. So those kind of sections, I think, are good for that you can have that high difficulty, but you feel like every time you're getting a little bit further and taking a couple more layers off and getting farther every time. So you're making progress every time you play it, as opposed to playing a really difficult action section. Sometimes you can just be like, all right, I'm going to restart this section. And then you just die, like, right on the first thing, because you happen to not be quick enough on the draw against the first enemy.
Let's do a sponsor, and then I want to talk about this sort of trade-off of if games are hard, what that means for who can enjoy them. So this episode is brought to you by the Wii U. The Wii U is a modern HD video game console boasting 2 gigabytes of RAM, a 1.2 gigahertz CPU, and of course, USB 2.0. You guys know for the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One how you have to subscribe to a monthly fee to play games online? Have you guys seen that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Wii U does not have that problem. In fact, there's no way to play online at all. So it solves that completely. The Wii U's extensive collection of games includes titles as Super Mario 3D World, Zen Pinball 2, Cloudberry Kingdom, Fist of the North Star Ken's Rage 2, and Puddle. With the 5 new games released this year, the Wii U now has twice as many games as the Sega 32X. So, thanks to the Wii U, we wish you luck. So I wanted to bring up a point about game difficulty that I thought was really interesting. John Siracusa has brought this up on Hypercritical as well as Accidental Tech Podcast, which is this trade-off of games, the insistence of the hardcore gamers demographic of games having a certain amount of difficulty for them necessarily means that people who are not very practiced gamers, or maybe have never really played any modern games, literally cannot play the games. And that's something that's very different than any previous form of media, right? Like, if you are looking at film or if you're looking at art, you know, nobody is incapable of watching a film. Well, okay. Very few people are incapable of watching a film, right? You don't need to, like, play hundreds of hours of films in order to be able to watch this really difficult film. If you want to just go and watch the Oscar-winning film for Best Picture this year, you just watch it and then you're like, hey, that was great, or not, but you can just get into it by watching it. And video games have this weird property where the more challenging it is, you're inherently excluding, like, not just, you know, the people who are really bad, but actually, like, most human beings on Earth are literally not competent enough to get through, you know, these games, even get far enough into them that they even get the sense of the game. And I was really struck by this when my dad recently, we kept talking about Portal, you got to play Portal. And my dad, like, he likes games. Like, he's played World of Warcraft and Diablo, and, he plays a fair number of games and he loves board games and things like that. But he's always been pretty disinterested in first person shooters and never really got the mechanics down. His reflexes are not very good with them, and his instincts around them are not very good. And he's just not used to the controls. And so I think I might have bought him Portal. And a few weeks later, I'm like, oh, how do you enjoy Portal? And he's like, it doesn't make any sense. You can't do anything. I couldn't do anything. And I'm like, what do you mean you couldn't do anything? Like, what does that even mean? He's like, yeah, I just went around to this room and there's this glass and stuff like that. And I was stuck. And I don't know. I spent like a half an hour and I couldn't do anything. And I realized that like he never even got the portal gun. Oh, he didn't even get to that point of like, well, that's like the second room or the third room. But like he just never even got that far. And he was just like, this game sucks. Like, I guess it's too hard or it's designed poorly or something like that. And Portal is not like a really hard game. Like, it's not a hardcore game. It's a, you know, relatively friendly game, but it's still like somebody who's into games, likes games, you know, is pretty good at some games, wasn't able to get through the first level. And that was really sad to me.
I mean, I think it's an interesting, like, I think all games should be, you know, I'm quote unquote a hardcore gamer apparently. And I don't, you know, I'm not that person to be like, oh, games should be hard and I should only be able to play them. Like, they genuinely should be accessible. But it's interesting to talk about something like Portal, which, I don't know, in my opinion, is one of the most accessible, like, sort of well-designed early experiences in games. And, like, there are still people that can't play it. And I think that I think we take for granted how much, I don't know, it's sort of like a parallel to, like, iOS is probably a reasonable example, especially the new one, where, like, iOS historically has had a lot of really good affordances and it's been really easy for anybody to use. And as time is going on, we're starting to, I think, expect people to have some understanding of touch interfaces and thus make things like a little bit more abstract and a little bit more obscure. And I think video games are like sort of the ultimate embodiment of this, right? Like it's been a niche industry for a really long time. And those of us who've been playing for a long time, just there's things that we intrinsically know. Like if I can't get out of a room, I'll look in every corner, but that's not something most people do. Like that's actually kind of irritating. And I wonder how much of that is just because this hasn't been sort of mainstream media for, I mean, it's been mainstream media for a fairly long time, but I still think there's a long history of expectations, especially about designers. And I feel like that's sort of what affects people, especially like people like your dad or even my parents for that matter, where like there's this moment of like, there's some things you need to know about games in general that we aren't going to teach you. And that makes this inaccessible, which is not awesome.
And if they teach you those things, it's going to drive us crazy. Like, even as it is, like, games that have these intro sequences where they force you to go through, and, you know, most AAA games have at least some amount of a tutorial mode, they're always straining to find some excuse where it's like, all right, you got to teach the troops these, you know, basic moves just so that they can join you in battle. So shoot the target by pressing R1 and, like, or something, you know? And even that is not enough for a lot of people, unfortunately, in the world. Like, you know, my dad is, even with that tutorial, you know, he's going to end up going off into the corner or something like that. And that's, I'm not sure what the solution to that is, but what it does make me think is that these arguments against games like, you know, Gone Home or Papers, Please as being, I think Gone Home is the good extreme example of a game where you can't die and you can't lose. Like, I don't think that that's, makes it not a game, but maybe that's just my emotional connection with enjoying video games and wanting them to spread, and therefore a game that, you know, feels like a first-person shooter and you can get some of the story experience of one without necessarily getting stuck in the first room.
There are plenty of games that you can't die, though, that are still fairly punishingly hard. A lot of the Golden Age adventure games are like that. You can't die in any of the Monkey Island games. Well, okay, that's not completely true. There's,
for the most part, you can't die in the Monkey Island games.
There's, I think, one of the Monkey Island games that you can die in if you really, like, push your way past a lot of warnings that if you keep doing the thing you're doing, that you're going to die. And it's more or less played as a joke in that case. But for the most part in those games, you can't die. But they're still very inaccessible games to casual gamers because the puzzles are so obtuse, right? You really need to be steeped in the mindset of, you know, N-way combinatorics of objects in your inventory to try and solve puzzles. And so I don't think it's necessarily about whether or not you can die. It is about how much effort you need to expend to progress through the game, right? Death is the most common blockage on further progress in games because so many games are about killing and dying, but you can make games where there's problem-solving mechanics other than that that are just as inaccessible. And conversely, you can make games that you don't really need to do much in the way of work to progress through the story, that anyone of sort of a basic skill level can kind of keep moving through them, but those sorts of experiences can be really unsatisfying to people that like gameplay and that enjoy being challenged and learning new stuff.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like there's this distinction between the casual gamer and the hardcore gamer, and sort of the way I've always thought about it is that when you look at sort of what is sort of the bulk of casual gaming, and if we want to like bump casual gaming up to World of Warcraft, for example, I find that a lot of it is it's sort of like repetitive tasks. Whereas for hardcore gamers, maybe this is me being, you know, self-indulgent, but I feel like there's a lot more variety. Like the things that hardcore gamers find really interesting is like ever-changing landscapes, mechanics that change on you fairly frequently. Whereas, you know, things like Candy Crush or, I mean, even like Flappy Bird, which an Angry Birds, like they're repetitive and you can kind of keep playing them in the same way that you learned. WoW is the same thing over and over again, just with different dressings. You're just collecting shit and bringing it somewhere else. And like, as I've gotten, like I was a shameless WoW addict for a number of years. Like I ran a guild and did like 40 man raids back in vanilla. Like I loved that game. And every MMO I try now, I can't do it. I just find it dissatisfying. There's no like mechanical interest there for me. And as I find as I get older, like that's what's keeping me going. Whereas like when you look at what's sort of super popular, I feel like it is just more repetition. Like that's what people are glomming onto. They want something to do.
I think it's a different kind of repetition that appeals to hardcore gamers. Like I think for me, what really scratches the itch is repetition of mechanics, like learn a small set of mechanics that you can reuse and find interesting ways to combine. And then you get presented with a new situation. It's like, all right, which tools can you pull out of your bag to solve this situation? So you're learning it. You're learning at a slightly higher level, right? You're saying, here's a mechanic that I can repeat in different situations, and I need to know which one to pick, how to approach solving this problem or taking out this enemy or sneaking past this guy. Whereas I think casual gamers is a lot more repetition of the scenarios, right? It's not that you're learning some underlying mechanic that you need to figure out how to reapply to different situations. It's you're just being presented with the same situation
with bigger numbers.
Yeah, but sort of building even more on that, like you're mentioning the whole idea of like there's things in Golden Age adventure games that you just intrinsically need to know about them. I think that sort of hardcore game mechanics is a lot of sort of self-reference, whether it be to like games in general or even the mechanics you're learning like at that time. And it kind of relies on you to either remember things about games you should be thinking about or like things you've learned earlier in the game and combining them in like new and interesting ways.
But this even happens when we look at sequels. A sequel will generally feel easier to the person who played the previous one, even if the difficulty is the same, because you're like, yeah, I know, like, I press R1 to kick ass, and then I hold square, and then I assassinate people when I walk up to them, and then you're just, like, running around being awesome, whereas somebody who's never played the game before, they pick it up in the second or the third one, they still need that intro content, and so it feels like the series is getting easier because you're not actually being challenged with new things, or at least not initially.
Which makes you sort of wonder, like, if games feel easier. I mean, I do genuinely believe there's a degree of, like, I don't know. I don't feel like games are getting easier so much as they're getting a lot friendlier and they're just designed better. But I do wonder, like, how much of when I play a game now is directly related to how many games I've played in the past. And that's why games in general, to me, feel easier. Like, I don't know. Like, I know a lot about games. I know sort of the tropes of games. And when you, like, sort of have that metagame when you're playing anything, it kind of makes it intrinsically a little bit easier. And I do wonder how much of that is, like, the hardcore game community, you know, screaming bloody murder because they're making their games easier. Whereas like video games aren't that old of an industry. And like, I'm not that old and I've played through more or less the heyday of like early video games. And I feel like a lot of the people that are complaining about that are people who've grown up sort of like, you know, through the hard times and when games are really badly designed. But I think we all have this sort of internal knowledge about games that just makes us inherently a lot better at them because we know how to sort of game the system.
I think there's definitely some of that going on. I think what's going on with difficulty is that there's a bunch of different things feeding into making the games easier, that there is a certain amount of genuine, yes, games have gotten easier. And like I said, that's where you can pull in this sort of calibration of like, go back and play some classic games and see like, yeah, Super Mario Brothers Lost Levels is still really freaking hard. Like having played all the Mario games from since then did not make me any better at that game. I still suck at that game. And so you can say like, yeah, okay, difficulty's gotten a little harder for real, But there is also the factor of, yeah, some of us have gotten better at games. Like some, you know, I go back and play Super Mario World, for example, and it's not really as challenging as I remember it being. I think that's one of those things where it's a game that's kind of a little bit over that difficulty hump of they started making games a little easier there. And now that I've played a lot more games since then, that game's a lot easier for me to play than it was at the time. So you know, there's I've gotten better at the game. There's also this thing that I mentioned before of the range has gotten broader that the game's trying to support, and some of the difficulty has been offloaded to optional things, that there's a shorter path through a lot of games. And you take all of those factors and combine them together, and you can get an apparent very large decrease in difficulty out of stacking all of those. It's like, yeah, you're 20% better at games, and games have gotten 20% easier, and they've added these three difficulty modes, the easiest one of which is even easier than that. And now it's like, all right, well, if you play the game on the easiest difficulty mode and you've been playing games your whole life, it's really easy now. Whereas those combination of factors just didn't exist in those earlier games. There was the one path through the game, and you played that, and that was the difficulty that it was.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like I think that like that all that is really true, but I also think that games as like there are more games for more people. Because I feel like there are games now today that are harder mechanically than games there ever were back in the day. Like, you know, I'm gonna bring up Super Hexagon again, or like one of the other games that guy made, VVVVV. Those games are so much harder than anything I ever played in the NES days. And part of that is just like the movement is way quicker because we can actually mechanically support that kind of stuff. But I think they feel less brutal because they let you restart really quickly. And there's like a lot of really good checkpoint mechanics around them. But to your point, like, yeah, the range is getting broader, but I also think that to some extent, the range is also getting higher too. Like there are niche games made for people who want really hard games that are harder than anything we saw back in the day. Like the shmups you see, like Ikaruga, is I can't even understand that game. Like I can get two or three levels in and it just like explodes my brain. And then you watch these YouTube videos of these guys like dodging pixel by pixel these bullets that are literally filling the screen, and like that is not something that existed, you know, more than like 10 years ago. So like the argument that like games are getting easier, I kind of agree as a whole, maybe the average is dropping, but I also want, you know, I feel like it's important that we appreciate that like they're also getting a lot harder.
Something that keeps coming up in various discussions that we have about this stuff is the game industry is just getting a lot broader right now. This came up a lot when we were talking about in-app purchases a couple episodes ago, where one of the key questions with in-app purchases is it actually hurting games that try and provide a more meaningful experience, or is it just that it's opened up this new market that didn't exist before? And I think that's the same kind of question to ask here is, okay, so maybe the average is dropping, but is the average dropping because all games are getting easier, or is the average dropping because more people that don't want hard games are entering the industry? And so this huge new market has opened up for games that aren't as challenging, and there's still just as big a market for really challenging games as there was before from a raw numbers perspective, but that's now a much smaller segment of the industry. And so you don't have mainstream games that are going out to everyone that owns NES that are that hard. You just have these niche things that, okay, people that really want hard games should get these indie games that are famous for being really hard and get their enjoyment out of that. And, you know, those people might feel like they're being done a disservice by the game industry as a whole getting easier, but maybe they aren't really. Maybe there's still just as much of a market for those kind of games as there was before. And the fact that the market's gotten bigger now means that it looks like they've got a smaller piece of the pie than they did before.
Well, I think we know now that there is actually a really mainstream market for really hard games, such as Flappy Bird. Like, if you do the difficulty in such a way that you take out those two really frustrating things about difficulty, which are you don't know why you died, which in Flappy Bird, you know exactly why you died. You hit the pipe. I mean, the hit detection is a little questionable, but you know why you died. And the other thing is that you restart really quickly. And so those are the, you kind of dial those down to 1 out of 10 on the frustratingness of the difficulty. And it's still frustrating, but you're spending almost your entire time playing.
Yeah, it's super funny because there was that one last update he made right before he took it off the App Store, which removed like the extra couple of seconds between a replay, and that was like probably the best thing ever. I remember I played a lot more just because of that. But to your point, Nigel, like I think that it's a bit short-sighted for people to say that video games are getting easier and it's like diluting the industry, because I feel like things like all these sort of hardcore niche games wouldn't really exist in the same way that they do without the game industry really becoming a lot bigger. And like, I don't know, there's like, regardless of whether or not these casual games and stuff are easy, like they're teaching us a lot about game mechanics in general. And I think like the industry as a whole benefits from it being bigger and more popular. And we do get like these really strange niches and people design like really intentionally for hard games. Like I can be like, I want to make my game really hard. And I think that if industry wasn't big enough, you probably wouldn't feel like you had the latitude to make something that specific. Overall, it's way better.
Yeah, I think the current situation is definitely better. But I understand where people that are freaked out by it are coming from, right? There's always this sense when you've got like your club and it's like all the cool people that you like in your club, and then now a whole bunch of other people are interested in the thing that your club is interested in, and you know, they've sold out the people that are making this stuff that you like. Like, people, you know, I understand why people get upset about that. But yeah, on the whole, more people and more different things being tried is probably going to benefit the industry. It's going to make it so that there's a wider range of experiences, and that the bits that are new and kind of suck will get whittled off eventually. And then it'll just be, now we can get the really cool experience out of this thing that was, you know, that was making things really easy or really hard or making the economics really crummy for a while. And yeah, I think on the whole, it's a positive long-term trend, but people that are annoyed about games getting too easy, I think probably it's just a little bit of like, well, this is my toy and you're not playing with it the right way.
Yeah. And I think it's exacerbated even more just by the fact that, like, traditionally speaking, like, video games have been kind of a nerd thing. Right. And, you know, for better or worse, nerds are the outcasts. And I feel like, as you know, that was the thing that we had growing up, that, you know, we would stay after school and play Warcraft 2 in the computer lab and all these things that like weren't cool at all. Well, I mean, they were cool for us, but like nobody else. And all of a sudden, you know, you got the Halos of the world and like the Call of Duties of the world and the Candy Crushes of the world. And all these people who never played video games are now like, oh, video games are awesome. And you're like, the fuck you, man. This is like, this was my thing. Like, you weren't allowed to have this. This is what I like suffered through childhood to become good at. And now you're like you said, like you're taking my toy. And I think there's a lot of animosity among gamers about that, because it's, I don't know, that's like a guttural feeling. And like, it's hard to recognize that, you know, it is actually okay that everybody likes what we're playing now. And it's okay to share your toys. It's actually all really good things. It just makes everything better for everybody. But I think there's, I don't know, like for me, especially growing up, like that was a pretty guttural reaction. Like, you know, you had like the frat boy people who played video games, and you always kind of resented them because like they didn't fully appreciate like what it took to get here.
Yeah.
All right. I think we got a good show. Thanks for listening, everybody. Check out the show notes at www.upup.fm, and it would help us a lot if you go and rate the show on iTunes. Otherwise, this message will recur every time you listen to this episode.
I really wanted to talk about Eve, but I decided that would be a little bit obscure.
Eve, like Eve Online, the spaceship combat multiplayer game?
Yeah, because the game is fascinating because it's not... It's super hard. Like, I've tried to play a game, like, 5 times. It's fucking crazy. And I've got, like, I had an old roommate that, like, plays it still, and all he does, literally all he does is mine. Like, he has a second screen, and he has Eve running, and he has a ship that, like, his drones. The drones do all the work, and then he, like, flies the ship away, flies another ship in, picks up, like, the cargo, and, like, brings it to a station. And he, like, loves the shit out of it. And then, like, you read the stories of, like, how interesting the game can become, like, at the later level. And it's, I just, that game is fascinating to me, because it's both incredibly monotonous and, like, one of the most compelling emergent gameplay stories ever in the history of video games. Like,
here's my thing with EVE Online. It is like the only game that I've never played and probably never would play, not because I don't think I'd like it, but just because it would have the capacity to fill my entire life up with playing it.
It's totally true.
Anytime there's any article about it that like comes across in my RSS reader, I read it. Like it is fascinating just to look at. It feels like what I sort of imagined massively multiplayer games were like, you know, like when you originally described that there's going to be this game that's going to have all these people in it. And you're like, yeah, there's going to be like emergent stuff and like people building their own things. And then you play World of Warcraft or something. It's like, all right, you got to go and collect the like 8 pelts and bring them back to the guy. And
whereas you know, EVE Online is the game where you spend like 2 years working your way up from like this like intern up to the president of this giant corporation that literally controls like huge amounts of money that actually equal real world money. And then you actually kill the person who owns the company and blow up his ship and steal like large quantities of real money and basically just laugh the way all the way to the bank.
Well, it's super interesting. There's a Polygon article like less than 2 weeks ago that did like this cool, it was like a really in-depth article where they like went and interviewed sort of like the key players throughout EVE's history. And they like went through like how it used to be the Russians versus the Scandinavians versus the Americans in like the first couple of years of it. It's interesting because the way that the EVE designers always describe the game is that they didn't build a game. They built basically a system and a set of constraints. And the game is defined literally entirely by the people, like down to the fact they have like a player elected council that does consultation with CCP on the game design. Like it's so nuts.
The title of the article, I believe, is EVE, the most thrilling, boring game in the universe.
Best article title ever.
I read like everything on that recent massive battle that they had. I think it was like a month or something back. And it is. It's like reading an exciting bit of real world history. Like just how many crazy mistakes led into the initial conflict and then how it just snowballed and like tens of thousands of real world dollars worth of damage.
$500,000 was the final $300,000 to $500,000 of real money versus ships.
But it's awesome. Like it's great that exists. It's something I'm really glad it exists, even though I couldn't possibly have anything to do with it. Like,
yeah, totally. Like it's gives great, you faith in games in general. And oh man, yeah. That being said, like I don't know, you mentioned WoW briefly there and how like it felt like the 8 pelts thing. There's a point in WoW where the game completely changes.
I never really played it. I've only sort of seen other people play it and hear stories of it. I do know that the end game once you get into the big guilds is a little better than that, but
It's slightly ridiculous.
Well, it used to be that you needed to spend 100 hours to get there, but just in the last couple of weeks, you can now pay $60 to just skip the entire game and you get to the end of the game.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, right? Because like Endgame and WoW changed like dramatically after the first expansion. Because the first game, like you needed 40 people to run Endgame content, which is like, that's a lot of fucking people to organize in general. And then on top of that, like at the end of the day, like I'm not super perturbed by the whole like pay to level thing, because at the end of the day, like end game content was like, if I take the heinous thousands of hours I played of that game, like 98% of those hours were spent at max level. Like the game completely changed and I was playing a completely different game the moment I hit max level. Now that's not, I mean, that's still fairly true, but like speaking of difficulty changing, like WoW is a really, really interesting case study. And like original WoW had like all the shitty bad design tropes that MMOs before had, and as WoW has evolved, you've seen things like, you know, now quest things glow so you can actually see them and not drag your mouse over the screen pixel by pixel to see if the cursor changes. Like all these little like nice changes that actually make the game a lot quicker. you know, you could argue it makes it easier. And like, you know, we had to level back in the hard days when like quests were hard and there wasn't like tons of documentation online to help you find everything. But at the end of the day, like it actually makes for a more enjoyable game because it's, you know, unless you're in high school or, you know, slacking off at university, it's really hard to commit your time really heavily to an MMO.
I think that's true of any multiplayer game, even non-MMO type games, that the difficulty ramp on something like a competitive first person shooter. Like I played a fair bit of Unreal Tournament back in the like Unreal Tournament 2003 days. And I had to stop playing, not because I didn't like it, but just once I had kids, I didn't have enough time to play to not feel like a complete klutz every time I started playing again, right? When I was playing for like an hour or two most nights in a week, I could feel like, yeah, I'm on top of this. I know what's going on. My skills are in reasonable shape. And then if I took like a month off from playing and then started playing again, I'd be like, well, this is useless. And then a new game would come out and I wouldn't start in on it immediately, and I'd try and play it, and I'd be like, "Well, I'm hopeless. I can't accomplish anything.
I'm screwed." Yeah, it's funny because like games like StarCraft and Dota, which I've played a fair bit of both of, like those are the worst for that because like not only is there this mechanical hurdle you have to maintain, there's also this insane metagame hurdle that is not only like something you have to be aware of, but you have to be aware of like day to day and like month to month because like they add a new hero or they do a patch update and that like completely changes like overall strategy. And I found, like, especially after I moved to San Francisco and I've been, like, you know, I haven't had as much time for games, is, like, my game time on things like Dota and StarCraft has just, like, floored because I can't dedicate, like, the mental energy to, like, keep up with the news as well as, like, play it frequently so I have, like, the mechanical dexterity to play it. Like, I don't know. I feel like multiplayer games have gotten tremendously more complex and potentially by virtue of that, more difficult. I mean, I guess they're more difficult just by virtue of the fact more people play them. So more competition is just hard.
I got into StarCraft 2 when it came out and it was having a lot of fun with it. I'd never gotten into an RTS that much, but I was playing pretty regularly, a fair number of hours each week, and got the metagame and the strategies. And I sort of knew what to expect. Okay, well, if he builds this around this time, then probably this is what's going to happen. And then I took like maybe 6 months off, maybe 8 months off. And then I came back and played a couple of games. And both times, the player I was playing against did some completely absurd strategy that destroyed me because I would never even occur to me that someone would do that. Like, the first game I played, some Terran starts building his barracks, like, blocking my ramp so I can't get out of my own base. And I'm just like, I basically, as soon as I saw he did that, it didn't even occur to me to check to see if he was doing that. And I was just like, well, I'm dead now. And then I just type in the chat. I'm like, is this a thing now? And he's like, it is now. Like,
yeah,
it's a thing
rough.
Now, and you have to know that, and if you don't, then you die.
And like so much, it's crazy to me because that game like gets so deep because there's like, you know, sort of like the cheesy win strategies that someone finds, and like at a like a bronze to gold level, you'll have like a tremendous amount of success with it. And like I had a couple of friends that were playing at like the diamond level, and I would just sort of talk to them about the game, or you'd like watch Day 9 talk about it. You know, they do like a quick scout of the base with their SUV. They'd be like, oh, okay, he's got this gas building now, and he's got this barracks building now. So that means he's going for this strategy, this strategy, this strategy, which means this is end game. He's going to have X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, that's so much information. And like, there's so many permutations of these builds, and like, all that knowledge is like, it's crazy. And like you said, like, it changes, like, not even a 6 month scale, it changes like a 1 month scale. Like, it's nuts.
Yeah, it's tough though, right? It's something that really, you know, we're at one level kind of looking down at like, oh yeah, these people that can't like move around in first person shooters and stuff like that, we're so much better than them. But you look up the food chain, and there's the people that play these competitive multiplayer games who are playing a different game than we are. That has all of that metagame and strategy, and everything changes day to day, and you need to be in it all the time to understand what's going on. And it's another aspect of that, you know, people have to find their own level and pick the set of games that works for them in terms of how much time they've got to devote to getting good at it. And some types of games just don't reward people that aren't willing to put a certain amount of effort into them or learn a certain level of tricks, and
yeah,
you're just kind of locked out of those.
I think like StarCraft deserves a bit of credit, because like I remember trying to play Warcraft 3 and StarCraft, and they were like the gate to even play any level of competitive multiplayer was stupidly high. And like, to their credit, like the matchmaking system in StarCraft 2 is actually pretty damn good. Like, I know people who play at a very, I mean, in StarCraft terms, which is obviously like relative to the rest of the game industry, is still kind of high, but like they can play at bronze and be super happy like doing bronze level play. And then you look at like, you know, each level, like how much the game changes, but the fact that they can still facilitate those people and like let them have an enjoyable experience, I think it's testament to like a really good matchmaking system and actually making a game that can be incredibly inaccessible, actually fairly accessible to a fair number of people.
Well, it's easy to overrate though in that game how, or any of these multiplayer games that there's a lot of people playing out there that are playing at a really high level, that what, so bronze is the lowest league in StarCraft, and I play maybe 100 or 200 games at bronze league in StarCraft, to the point where I was at the high end of bronze level, but I would play my friends who had played the single player StarCraft campaign, and they'd beaten it on hard, and they felt like they're pretty good at the game, but I could annihilate them. Like, they just couldn't do anything against me. But I was considered ranked one of the bottom StarCraft, like actively playing StarCraft players in the world that was even just playing the game at all, because anyone who, like 98% of people who would play the single player, they would go online, they would get annihilated by someone like me, who the game considers to be really bad, so it puts them against them. But like, I know how much units cost, and I know the shortcuts to build them, and that puts me at like a 50% advantage to them.
Yeah, and there's that sort of like early time, they like later in the expansion, they added like a ton of, it was like AI, like versus AI progression. So you'd be able to be like, we're going to test your skill, and then you're going to like rank up through the AI ranks before you like have a chance to play against real people. And they also had like an unranked league and stuff like that. Because the weird part about StarCraft is that single player doesn't prepare you for multiplayer in any way. Like, nothing. Like, there's custom units, and like the mechanics are totally different, and you can upgrade your units to have like special abilities you can never access in multiplayer. And in that respect, like, you know, that's an interesting point. It's like, I don't know if that is considered a failure, but it is kind of fascinating how like StarCraft is literally two different games. There's the single player, and then there's everything else.
That's true of a lot of games. I mean, a lot of games have separately developed single player and multiplayer components these days. It's not even the same teams doing it, and they are almost made like separate games. I think what's different in a game like StarCraft that's a strategy game versus like a first person shooter is the skill set in StarCraft is all about knowing the strategy, whereas in a first person shooter, a good chunk of skill set is just getting comfortable with the controls, and the controls at least are the same. You know, once you figure out, okay, how do I aim? What's the sensitivity on aiming? How do I lock in, you know, use the like lock on mode correctly to track targets, and whatever other quirks of the control system, which weapons are good in which situations. A lot of that stuff you can learn in the single player game, and the knowledge transfers over to some degree, whereas something like StarCraft, it's a lot of the strategic stuff just doesn't map across.
But I don't think that's the big problem with StarCraft. I think it's just the difficulty. Like, the difficulty of StarCraft single player hard being good enough, even if you just made the AI as difficult as like a comparable just one versus one battle that was as hard as the single player hard in StarCraft, you would get completely annihilated in Bronze League online, just because, you know, even to play like high Bronze League, you have things like, if you don't know the keyboard shortcuts for building your buildings, and you have any times where you have buildings that you aren't producing any units, or you have your resources accumulating and you're not spending them, those are like, you know, sort of basic errors that in the single player game, you don't need to get those out of your game in order to be able to pass the levels until you get to the very high difficulty levels. Whereas multiplayer, everyone is beyond that.
And I think to some extent, like, I think it's just sort of where the mechanical skill lies in those games. Like, FPSs are, I don't know, like, if we're going to, like, pick percentages of, like, what you need to be good at a game, like, a twitchy first-person shooter is, like, probably, like, 90% mechanical proficiency, and then, like, 10% sort of, like, knowing strategy, like, map and all that kind of stuff. It's probably not quite that weighted. Whereas, like, StarCraft, you know, there's a lot of mechanical stuff you need to learn, but so much more of it is just strategy, and, like, the skills you learn in single player about resource management and like building a base from scratch and like expansion. They don't teach you any of that. And those are like just so ridiculously fundamental. Whereas like in an FPS, you know, jumping, shooting, taking cover, switching weapons, throwing grenades, like all that stuff you get to do in single player, at least not quite to the level you'll need in a multiplayer. But I feel like that primer is a lot. It's a better foundation for moving into a multiplayer situation.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Tyson.
Yeah, thanks. That was good.
Cool. Thanks, guys. That was super fun.